get part of the way up before slipping back to the ground. The thought of starting that engine while they're climbing floats through my mind. I mean, how funny would that be, watching them get launched over one of the hangars? Not realistic, as the propellers don't rev up that fast, but the idea is humorous. The rain coming down is definitely impeding their ability to hang on to the blade. I keep an eye out because they could potentially damage the aircraft, stepping on control surfaces and other vital areas should they get on top. I watch as the pack outside leaves, only to be replaced by another of about the same size. The storms have tapered off to intermittent flashes of light in the distance. I decide to experiment and open up slightly. I want to see if they can sense me when I do. I immediately sense the night runners and the images of the apparent leader. The leader turns in my direction abruptly as all activity ceases for a moment. Well, I guess that answers that question, I think, as the moment passes and they resume their efforts. I send a quick message of me associated with the sun. I notice the leader is immediately startled. There's a hesitation, but only a very slight one. The others also pause and look to the pack leader as if looking for guidance, but then immediately return to what they were doing. Well, at least it causes a little distraction, I think, wondering if I can send them instructions and have them obey. I send a series of images to one of the night runners just under the window, telling it to go into the hangar directly across the ramp. That does absolutely nothing. So much for being able to take control, I think. Perhaps it's because they realize I'm not one of them. So I can't control them. Oh well, it was worth a try, I say quietly to myself, as I gather up my ripe clothes and head back to the cargo compartment. The pack assaulting the exterior leaves a short time later and is not replaced. The rumbles of thunder vanish into the night as well, leaving us in comparative peace. The quiet is almost as startling as the noise, but I'm not complaining. We set up a schedule for watches and fold where we can on the steel deck and bunks to rest. The night passes and the morning comes with little disturbance from either Mother Nature or motherfuckers. I rise and stretch the kinks out. There are more than a few of them. The air inside is warm and stuffy from so many bodies in one place for an extended period of time. The ramp is lowered and cool air sweeps in, refreshing the stagnant interior. The light of the dawn filters in, and we all groggily step outside in ones and twos, hoping for the new day to invigorate us. Soldiers grabbing meals and water park themselves in small groups near the rear of the aircraft. The Humvees are opened up and placed in flanking positions. Provisions for the coming trip to Lubbock are set in neat piles next to the open ramp. The earlier we're off on our adventure, the more time we'll have to look for McCafferty's family and deal with anything unforeseen that may arise. I hear the sound of vehicles approaching in the distance. I radio Greg and Echo Team standing guard, telling them to be alert. I let the soldiers around the ramp know what I hear and get some funny looks, but there's a scramble to dispose of wrappers and water bottles. In short order, Blue Team has taken cover behind the concrete barriers near the edge of the ramp. I wait with Red Team near the aircraft, ready for any eventuality. Cars enter the ramp between two hangars, hesitate a moment, and then begin driving in our direction. The guns on the Humvees track their progress. Eight cars, packed with people, approach and stop a short distance away. Miguel steps out of the car in front, and I tell everyone to relax. The group from our little encounter yesterday has arrived. More people step onto the ramp as Blue Team leaves their cover and meanders back to us. I hear Gonzalez gasp beside me. She gives me a quick look, asking if it's okay if she goes. I nod, and she takes off in a run. She races past a small knot of people that have gathered around Miguel and embraces an older woman. Okay, older being relative, as she appears to be only a little older than me. I notice Gonzalez's younger sister Isabella join in the embrace. Gonzalez has apparently found her mother. Miguel and several others gather around. He quickly tells his story about he and a couple of his friends gathered everyone in the neighborhood when they figured out what was happening. They cleared the area as best they could and fortified the high school gym. They had run-ins with some roving gangs, but they managed to hold their own. He mentioned collecting weapons and ammo that were lying around on the base, and that's what's given them the edge so far. He also added that they were beginning to run low on supplies. I inform him that we're heading down to Lubbock for the day to search for one of our soldiers' family.
"You're taking your entire group?"
he asks. "Yeah, running into you yesterday made me want to have everyone available just in case. I was thinking of leaving the three we met in Albuquerque, but haven't decided on that yet," I answer.
"And you trust us?"
he asks, tilting his head to the side, confused. "It's not like you're going to steal our plane," I reply with a chuckle.
"What about your supplies?"
"Look, we have more back home. If you decide you don't want to come with us, take what you need. Just leave us some food, water, and ammo," I answer. Miguel pauses and then says,
"No, I think we'll be staying with you guys. Like I said, there's nothing here for us anymore. I'll leave some people here to keep your shit safe until you get back."
"Sounds good. And thanks. We'll be back before dark."
"I hope so, or your shit's gonna be open for anyone to steal. We're not hanging around once the sun hits the horizon."
"I'll see you this afternoon." Gonzalez gives her mom and sister another hug before heading back. Miguel and his group pile back into their vehicles and, with a great flourish, drive away with the sounds of their vehicles fading into the distance. He leaves one car and several people behind. Silence spreads across the ramp, and we're left alone with the beginning of the day. The morning is chilly, but I can feel the heat already beginning to rise from the concrete ramp. The sky overhead is clear of clouds and promises a sunny day free from storms. The moist, humid air mass that gave rise to the majesty of the thunderstorms has moved on. Packing our gear together, the sound of the starting Humvees resonates off the metal sides of the hangars a short distance away and breaks across the still morning air. I leave with Red Team and search the base for another Humvee. It takes a while, but eventually we come across a couple parked in a maintenance area. The second one we try starts, and we drive it back to the ramp. Greg and Echo Team pile into the third Humvee, and we're ready shortly to head out into the day. Leaving Thomas, Laurel, and Jeremy behind with Miguel's people, we exit the base and proceed along the same road as yesterday, driving in the same formation, with the exception that Greg is in my lane offset from Horace. McCafferty is driving as we pass the familiar brown fields. There are patches of green from the rains of the days prior, already springing up as only it can in the desert. We pass through the ghost-like town of Clovis. The downpours have cleaned the streets of sand to a degree, but the runoff has left still wet sand piled against the curbs and by the tires of the few parked cars. The bottom of the doorway entrances are still filled with dirt and debris where they're inset from the street. It gives that lonely and abandoned feel of most towns that we've seen, either from the air or ground. I keep an eye out for any of the roving gangs Miguel mentioned, but we pass through without incident. A few miles out of town, the highway turns to the southeast. The scenery doesn't change much as we begin our journey to Lubbock. McCafferty, in the driver's seat, is displaying much of the same tightness around her eyes that Gonzalez did the day before. I'm guessing she's worried about what Gonzalez found with regards to her dad, and thinking the same thing could be awaiting her. The scale of sorrow was tipped, however, when Gonzalez found out her sister and mother were still alive. And to be honest, it was fortunate that she found her sister, or vice versa, really, when she did, as things were about to get ugly. Timing is such a wonderful thing. Luck doesn't hurt either. I just hope I have enough of both in my shrinking bag of tricks. Henderson, manning the top gun and keeping an eye out far ahead of us with a set of binoculars, pulls our attention to the fact that we're approaching a city or town of some sort. I notify the other teams and we slow to a stop. Taking a few moments to glass the area, Henderson reports no movement, and we press forward slowly. The highway passes along the outskirts of the town and is lined with warehouse and industrial-style buildings. It's definitely not the roadside burger, gas station, or strip mall kind of place. We pass through slowly, alert for any movement or indication that there are survivors. Nothing moves except an occasional dust devil swirling in dry, sandy lots. Our passage through the abandoned and empty town is quick, and we're once again presented with the same scenery. Brown, and mostly barren fields, with patches of green. A few small, stunted trees crop up here and there, but for the most part, you can almost see the curvature of the earth. Some of the fields we pass have cattle grazing aimlessly, while others have only dark lumps lying in them. It seems the surviving cattle are dependent on whether the water source and irrigation was natural or not. The natural irrigation is scarce, as this appears to be mostly an agricultural area, or at least it used to be. The scenery passes by with only the hum of our tires on the pavement, the air passing over the open turret on top, and the vibration of the diesel to keep us company. The vibrations and sounds are lulling.
Sir, we're approaching another town. It appears there are vehicles creating a roadblock on the highway before it,
Henderson calls out on the radio. Any movement? I ask as McCafferty begins to slow down.
I can't tell for sure with the heat waves. I thought I saw something, but I can't be certain, sir,
he answers. I radio the others and we come to a stop on the highway. I step outside with another set of binoculars and climb onto the roof. Standing on the roof, looking over the expanse through the binoculars, I'm reminded of a picture I once saw. It was of a German commander staring at Moscow from just a few miles outside of it. He was staring at the city with smoke rising all around. This was as close as he ever came, or anyone from the German side for that matter. It has no bearing on our situation, but the image comes to my mind anyway. Vehicles parked perpendicular to the road are definitely blocking the highway, but Henderson is right. The heat waves make it difficult to see if there is in fact anyone manning the roadblock. I focus off to the sides around the small town strung along the freeway. More dry fields separated by slightly raised dirt roads. There doesn't appear to be any road around the town, nor do I see any movement on either side. I'm hesitant to drive closer as there's always a reason for a roadblock. It could have been set up much earlier, and then the town fell into silence, like so many others. I lower my binoculars just as a spark strikes up from the road in front and to the left of us, accompanied by the familiar sound of a ricochet. The report of a gunshot reaches us a second later. Yep, someone just took a shot at us.
I guess that answers the question of whether the roadblock is being manned, I think, hopping off the roof.
Another spark and ricochet, closer this time, followed by the sound of the shot.
Fuck that. We don't have time for this, I say, hopping into the passenger seat and grabbing the radio.
Horace, Greg, get off the road to the right. We're going around this fucking town. Keep your spacing, but be able to support one another, I say, while directing McCafferty off the road. She guns it, and we head down a gravelly incline into a slight gully. Coming up the other side, we roll over a barbed wire fence and enter a dry, dusty field. McCafferty continues accelerating. The other vehicles enter the field behind. Although the field is fairly flat, our speed makes the ride a little bumpy. We begin leaving a large dust plume behind us. With little wind, the dust hangs in the air, partially obscuring Echo Team's vehicle. Horace remains in view behind and offset to the right, away from the town. "Greg, pull to the outside of Horace," I call.
"Roger that,"
he replies, and I see his Humvee swing out. This way, everyone will have a clear line of sight for driving, and the dust plume created by our vehicle should obscure both Horace's and Greg's. The sun glints and flashes off both windshields as they plow through the field. It's not a mad race across the dusty ground, but we don't have much time if we're to get down to Lubbock, look for McCafferty's family, and get back before dark. This is only one obstacle, and it's eating at our time available. I'm glad we left early. My plan is to circumvent the town and be on our way, as it's apparent they aren't in the mood for dinner guests.
"Sir, it looks like we have company heading our way," Henderson says over the radio.
I look past McCafferty to see plumes of dust rising in lines near where the roadblock was. I can't see what the vehicles are, but from the plumes, it appears they're trying to cut us off.
"What do you have, Henderson?" I ask.
"I see several pickup trucks and what looks like some ATVs,"
he answers between bounces.
"So much for trying to circumvent the town and being on our way," I think, grabbing for the microphone.
"Horace, Greg, we have company coming from the roadblock. Several pickup trucks and ATVs cutting across the fields toward us," I say, knowing they may not be able to see what's coming through the shroud of dust we're kicking up. I see the first of the raised roads coming up quickly.
"Henderson, hang on. Bit of a bump coming up," I say.
McCafferty slows only slightly. Our front tires hit the small rise, and we bounce over the narrow dirt strip, landing hard on the incline on the other side. I bounce once, leaving my seat, and tilt my head to the side to avoid the quickly approaching ceiling. Just as quickly, I slam down into my seat, and we're off once again. I look in the rear view to see Horace's Humvee rise over the berm and slam down on the far side. The headlights in front of Greg's vehicle shows, and he goes through the same leap.
"How are our guests doing?" I ask Henderson.
"Still coming, sir,"
he answers. I look to see the dust plumes angling our direction, still trying to cut us off. I can't believe pickup trucks and quads are coming after three Humvees. But maybe they don't know what they're chasing or didn't see all three of us. Whatever the case, I can't believe they would pursue. It doesn't look like we're going to outrun them, though. We can either engage them in the open or try to find a defensible location. They may outnumber us, but I'm more than willing to bet we outgun them. Their closure rate is eliminating many of our options. I was kind of hoping they would give up if we ran far enough, but that's obviously not going to happen. Plus, I'm not overly happy with them taking some shots at us on the road. As a matter of fact, I'm rather pissed. The one thing I'm worried about is someone coming from the other direction. If there's a roadblock on one end of town, I'm thinking there's another on the other end. The sound of something hard hitting the window next to McCafferty catches all of our attention. It's a loud tink that all of us immediately recognize. Our heads snap to the sound and see a starred chip taken out of the glass. A lucky shot, considering the speed and bouncing of both groups of vehicles, but a shot nonetheless.
"Weapons free," I tell Henderson and the other teams. "It's time for us to do something about this and take care of these fucking assholes. I mean, seriously, what the fuck do they think they're doing or hope to accomplish? Night runners are the issue, and here they are shooting at other people. Fucking pricks." I feel the anger, along with a little fear, building up inside.
"Horace, Greg, I want you to start falling back. They're about 200 meters at our 8 o'clock and angling to cut us off. Can you see them?" I ask.
"No, sir, I can't see anything in that direction through the dust cloud," Horace replies.
Greg answers the same.
"Good. That means they can't see you either. Fall back. We're going to cut to the right and lead them on. Horace, I want you to turn and charge through the dust and engage them on my command. Greg, fall further back and see if you can fall in behind them. We'll turn to the left and across their front. We'll have them on three sides and let them have it," I say.
"Copy that, sir,"
Horace responds.
"We'll give them hell, Jack," Greg responds. I'm thinking the M240s on top will give them something to think about. I see Horace and Greg fall further behind as they slow up. Are you ready on top? I ask Henderson.
Fucking right, sir,
he answers. Give him a short blast and then be ready for a turn to the right, I say. I hear the M240 begin to bark and send rounds toward our unwelcome guests. Tracers reach out toward the vehicles and merge with them. McCafferty makes a slight turn to the right, negating our pursuer's angle. The group turns with us. I alert Henderson of another upcoming bump, and we hit hard on the other side of yet another raised path. Henderson alerts us to the twinkle of return fire coming from the trucks. Apparently, they didn't like the tracers we sent in their direction. Horace and Greg have fallen back considerably to the point where I really only know where they are by the clouds of dust they're kicking up. I measure the distance through McCafferty's mirror of those that do not terribly like us near their nest, and Horace through my own mirror. They look to be about even. That means Greg will be behind them. I catch a sight of winking lights from the trucks, but there's no way they can come close to being accurate while on the go across these fields. That's where tracers and heavy calibers come in handy. There's also the fact that our guns are mounted and we have better training. I'm still stunned that they're chasing us. The why they shouldn't have will become quite apparent to them in about a minute. Get ready to turn, I tell McCafferty. Cut to the left and we'll come across their front. She nods while gripping the wheel tightly to hold the Humvee along its path. I give a heads up to Henderson.
I'm ready, sir,
Henderson responds. Horace, Greg, start your turns. Time to teach these bastards some manners, I call out. Horace's Humvee comes charging out of the dust cloud directly at the flank of the group of vehicles pressing in on us. She immediately turns to parallel the hard-charging trucks and quads, staying directly beside them. In the rear, Greg's Humvee races out of the same plume just after Horace's and angles toward the rear. I don't see any indication that they've been noticed as we seem to have their undivided attention. That will soon change. Tracers arc from Horace's Humvee, reaching out toward the unsuspecting group. They aren't a stream due to the fact that we're still racing across a field, but it looks accurate enough. The red streaks arc upward slightly and intersect one of the quads charging at us. Yeah, a quad versus a Humvee. I still don't get it. I'd hate to be the one charging after an armed Humvee on an ATV. The driver of said quad finds out about that unfortunate inequality. The meeting of the M240 rounds in the quad isn't pretty. The rider is thrown from his seat, causing the ATV to turn sharply and begin rolling violently in a cloud of dust and debris. Greg's tracers enter the fray and more dust clouds are created as his rounds find their mark. Still, the vehicles press onward. Looking at the action as best I can with the bumps and small windows, I'm guessing the majority of them still don't know they're under attack. I watch as another ATV goes end over end and throws its rider high into the air. I see the truck slew slightly off to the side, some toward Horace and some away. I guess she's been noticed now.
If they think Horace was a startle, won't Greg be a big fucking surprise?
I think, watching their once pristine line become a tangled mess. Okay, it's time to do our thing, McCafferty. Turn left, but keep angled so we don't catch any stray rounds from Greg, I warn Henderson. I'm pressed to the side as the Humvee slews to the left. Our top gun barks as Henderson adds his rounds to the fray. The scene is a lot of dust flying and bursts of tracers streaming towards vehicles which are now in disarray. I watch as the red streaks reaching out from our vehicle strike solidly on the front of one of the trucks. The truck digs down on its front wheels, turns slightly to the side, and flips, tossing people in the bed into the air, their arms and legs flailing as they try to gain some sort of equilibrium and failing miserably. They land hard and bounce across the field of dirt. Ahead and to the left, I notice another line of dust clouds heading our way. I'm guessing it must be vehicles from another roadblock on the other side of town coming to help. The group that was chasing us has given up trying to keep up with us and are now trying to evade the heavy rounds streaming into their vicinity.
rounds that are finding target after target. Any cohesiveness they might have had is lost. Most are trying to make it back to the roadblock, but having a hard time getting by Greg, who is firmly entrenched in their rear. Yes, that analogy does hold true here. Horace, Greg, let's finish this up here. We have more company coming in from the east. Give those fuckers a last shot so they think twice about coming back and rejoin me, I say, and direct McCafferty to turn and park with our rear to the oncoming vehicles. They're still a distance away, but closing quickly.
Copy that, sir,
Horace says.
We're on the way.
Be there in a sec,
Greg replies. The rounds from both teams cease, and what remains of our wannabe pursuers hightail it toward their roadblock location. A light dust hangs in the air over the fields, thicker where we engaged the vehicles. Plumes of smoke rise from stricken vehicles, and bodies lie on the ground. Some crawl slowly seeking refuge. Many lie unmoving on the dry, brown field. I wish I could have just loaded up a striker. I'm pretty sure they wouldn't tear after a striker with a fucking pickup truck and a deer rifle. Horace and Greg drive up and stop in line with spacing between. Our rears are to the oncoming vehicles in order to present the narrowest target and offer the best cover. We're ready to break away and flank if we need to. The dust cloud draws closer, and I begin to see individual vehicles ahead of the plumes. It appears to be the same mix as the other group, several pickup trucks and quads. Looking to the side at Horace and Greg, I see their guns trained on the advancing vehicles. I glance to make sure the first group isn't turning about, but it looks like they've had enough. Time seems to stand still for a moment. The dust cloud still billows, but it seems as if the vehicles causing it don't draw any closer. I feel the stifling heat inside the Humvee, but it's stowed in the background given the flow of adrenaline coursing through my body. Rivulets of sweat pour down my forehead and temples. In the back, Gonzalez and Denton gaze out of the small hatch window. McCafferty grips the steering wheel and is looking out of her rear view. I would love to add our own personal rounds to the upcoming fray, but that only increases our exposure and minimizes our mobility options. Here, on this lonely, dusty field in the middle of nowhere, a battle is about to begin. We're close to engaging yet another hostile force. The feeling of slowed time vanishes. The trucks rush onward as if they were suddenly vaulted ahead and become clearly visible. They must have some radio communication and know about what happened to the others, yet onward they come. I shake my head and press the transmit button in my hand. Open fire. Target the trucks on the outer edges and work your way in, I say. The M240 overhead opening up drowns out any other sound. Brass casings fall inside and are barely heard hitting the metal floor over the bursts of the large caliber gun. Tracers once again reach outward from Horace's and Greg's Humvees, streaking for and merging with the trucks racing our way. We're idle, so this time the red tracers become streams of fire. Not a solid stream like the fire from an AC-130, but potent nonetheless. Tracers intersect one of the pickups, causing a flash of steam, and the hood flies open. The truck slews to the side in a cloud of dust and comes to a stop. People pile out the back. The ones exiting closest to us are cut down by the continued bursts into the truck and are violently thrown against the side. Blood sprays against the blue paint, and the falling bodies leave bloody streaks as they slump to the ground. The windshield, at an angle to us, caves inward with a shower of glass as rounds hammer the driver and passengers. Blood splashes against the remaining shards, the side and rear window, and coats the interior. The scene is rapidly played out in a similar fashion across the dusty field as truck after truck is brought to a halt. It's over pretty quick as the remaining vehicles scatter and try to turn around. Horace, Greg, head out and take the northern flank. We're heading out on the southern flank. Watch your fields of fire, I say.
Heading out, sir.
Horace responds.
They're leaving. We should be able to skirt by them now, Greg replies.
I know, but we're going to have to come back this way, and we need to teach these fuckers proper greetings, I say.
That could piss them off more, Greg says.
It could, I reply.
Okay, heading out,
he says with a chuckle. I see Horace's and Greg's Humvee swing around to the north. McCafferty guns it, and we turn to the left, heading for the southern flank of the scattered vehicles. More spent cartridges fall inside as Henderson fires bursts at any vehicle that comes within range. The field becomes a swirling mass of dust and smoke once again. Riders are thrown from their ATVs. People left behind by the retreating mass rush to find cover behind the stopped or overturned vehicles. Some are flung backwards as 7.62mm rounds impact their bodies forcefully. Horace and Greg race around the northern side of the disorganized mass, creating more disarray. Vehicles and people are driving and running in random directions, trying to escape the fire. We sweep around the southern end. Those trying to escape the guns of the other two teams run into ours. The air between the teams is a maelstrom of dust, smoke, blood, steel, tumbling or damaged vehicles, and people either dying or trying not to. The group that started after us has been significantly reduced in numbers. Okay, let's head east and then swing back north to the highway past the town, I radio. Horace and Greg copy, and we exit the fray on the other side, heading across the fields, with the town sliding behind us on the left. Horace and Greg are in a staggered formation in line with us, separated by about 100 meters. McCafferty closes the distance, and we head back towards the highway, at a slower speed so we don't launch Henderson or have him drop a kidney. Behind us, dust hangs in the air with darker columns of smoke drifting lazily in the air. We pull to a stop outside the town's view. Setting a perimeter with the top guns manned, we walk around the vehicles inspecting each for damage. Besides the starred driver window, there are only a few pockmarks where rounds found their way to us. The race across the field sucked down our fuel to an extent, so we'll have to fuel up along the way somewhere. And the sooner the better, in my opinion, as it keeps the options open. The sun hangs in the mid-morning sky as we climb back in to resume our journey. The adrenaline is winding down, and I'm more aware of the stifling heat inside the Humvee. I notice the spent casings on the floor in the back and wonder what our return trip will be like. I definitely plan to circumvent the town. Taking side roads around would be the best option, but this place is very much lacking in any kind of side road. Looking at the map, we'd have to travel far out of our way if we used roads. We'll head into the fields much earlier and try to stay out of sight as best we can. We'll kick up dust for sure, but I'd be surprised to see whoever was in that town come chasing after us. But then again, I'm sure they're plenty pissed off. I just hope their fear outweighs their anger. Heading out in a staggered formation again, we head down the road. The light gray lanes stretch out ahead, straight as an arrow, as is common with the freeways of western Texas. There's not much to impede or cause the builders to make curves. The warm wind blows in my open window and brings a sour tang. The smell grows stronger the further down the road we go. I know this smell. It's the smell of rotting flesh. It's not as strong as I've noticed before heading down residential streets, but it's noticeable. I look around for housing areas or something that could cause that stench. The flat plains and fields are the only thing I see.
Surely this can't be coming from one of the small towns that dot the highway, or be drifting from the larger town of Lubbock many miles ahead,
I think, still surveying the area. This is much like some forays into other countries where, during our infill, we would catch the same odor. Those times it was because we were close to a mass grave or where a lot of people had been killed and just tossed to the side. I'm really hoping we aren't about to come up on something like that. That wouldn't bode well for our continued progress at all. We come upon the source of aroma soon enough. Cattle yards, off to the side of the highway. We pass by a few of them with hundreds and thousands of dead cattle lying in the enclosed pens. They must have died a while ago, and I'm grateful we didn't pass by here earlier. I sincerely doubt we would have been able to get this close because of the overwhelming stench. The disease rampant in those yards must be great. I can almost see the clouds of flies that must inhabit the air above those lifeless black dots, some in piles. The smell is strong enough to bring a gag reflex and makes my eyes water. McCafferty speeds up unconsciously as I roll up the window, preferring the heat to the odor. Henderson and the others on top must be green. We eventually pass by the multitude of pens, and the freeway bends around a larger town. There's no evidence of others, but we circumvent the city warily and on the alert. On the far end of town, I see a few semis parked in a lot close to an off-ramp. We aren't that far down on fuel and could stop on our way back, but it looks clear for now, and, well, we're here. I know I would feel better having full tanks again. I radio the others and we exit the highway. Getting back under the freeway, we pass a McDonald's on the right and turn into a small truck yard. We pass between two warehouse buildings before entering the yard proper. Several trailers are backed up to the loading docks with five tractor trailers parked in a line in the dusty lot. Grime coats their windshields and hoods. The fields beyond shimmer in the increasing heat. We park with Greg's Humvee covering the single entrance. Horace parks in the middle, covering the rest of the surrounding area, while we pull up to one of the semis. We'll refuel in shifts, making sure we're covered, our last little adventure strong in our minds. Stepping out, the lot and surrounding buildings have that same desolate feeling that every other abandoned place holds. I really wonder if this feeling will ever go away whenever we embark into areas that were once inhabited by mankind. Perhaps it's the memories of the places or the energy of the people gathered in one place that was suddenly whisked away. I'm more thinking it's my mind that's still sorting through seeing the relics of our civilization without the people that created them around. It's seeing things and what I'm still expecting to be associated with them. The sound of Gonzalez tapping down the fuel tank of the truck we've parked next to brings me out of my reverie. I'm a touch nervous about having to be in this place for so long. Cities, especially strange ones, have a negative connotation for me. There's no knowing what to expect, and having to be constantly alert is draining. The heat also tends to lull the senses. I almost wish I had the capability of sensing other people rather than night runners. I'd rather not be able to do even that, but it is what it is. It takes some time out of our day, but we're eventually on the road again without anything tragic befalling us. It feels good to be on the move once more. According to the map, Lubbock is not that far down the road, and the freeway circumvents the towns along the way. A few miles later, small housing development areas appear. They're still sparsely located, but they become more frequent the further to the southeast we travel. Right after one of the developments, McCafferty turns off the highway, and we start along a narrow country road.
"This skirts Lubbock to the north. My parents' house is on the east side, a little out of town,"
she says, as we journey through more farmland. The country road eventually ends at a T-intersection with another freeway, and we turn to the southwest and back towards Lubbock. The sun has risen overhead, pouring its rays directly upon us and the surrounding land, turning it into an oven. The sky remains clear, and for that I'm thankful. I'm anxious to search for McCafferty's family, get back to the airfield, and be on our way home. The stress of still having so much to do is weighing on me. It's not the intense feeling I had on our first arrival back to the Northwest after our trip to Kuwait, but it's there anyway. That was more about our short-term survival and setting up a place of safety, and this is more about developing our long-term needs. The stress is from the upcoming winter, and our losing our long-range mobility option due to weather and then the lack of fuel. I'm hoping Bannerman can come up with a biodiesel solution so we don't lose our power and ability to be somewhat mobile with vehicles. If we lose that, it will infinitely be more difficult to provide for our basic needs. We quickly come upon an area of houses and mobile homes set loosely apart and seemingly at random. Each abode is in its own dusty lot, with a few trees growing from the otherwise barren, dusty yards. Many of the places have old cars parked in the yards, and several of the houses also have semis parked alongside. McCafferty pulls off the highway and negotiates several streets before pulling up to a house set back from the road. "This is it, sir," she says, the Humvee idling just before the driveway. I watch as she scans the yard, house, and several buildings further back in the lot. A few cars are parked near a large garage structure. She looks back and apparently notices my checking the lot and cars.
"My dad likes tinkering with cars," she says,
putting our vehicle in gear and entering the lot. The adjacent houses and area are devoid of any movement. This is a place where you would expect barking dogs to greet you, whether ones at the house or from the neighbors. Nothing. We're still a little ways from Lubbock, and from the look of the development, it's secluded. I half expect McCafferty's parents to walk out of the house to greet us. I'm wary that there are sights tracking us, but I also think that her family would know a military vehicle, and with her in the military, assume she was coming to check on them. McCafferty pulls into the dusty yard a short distance from the front of the house. Greg and Horace park on the road in opposite directions, covering the surrounding area. A puff of dust rises from my boot as I step out. The others follow suit and exit. The wind blowing in the window kept the heat at bay as we were driving, but here, with us stopped and very little shade, it hits with full force. Yes, it's a dry heat, but it's like being baked instead of steamed. The day already seems long with the drive and our little adventure, but the sun's position overhead shows this to be an illusion. With Echo and Blue Team's covering, we approach the house. The windows and front doors are closed, so that's a good sign. Dust is gathered on the covered porch with none of the telltale footprints that normally come with night runners being inside. Wind could have obscured them, but the air is still. And if there were some inside, there should be some indication of them coming out at night. Sweat forms from the heat, but is quickly evaporated, leaving white rings and streaks on all of our fatigues. Checking our equipment and ensuring rounds are ready in our M4s, McCafferty climbs the concrete steps to the porch. We can't see directly inside as curtains are pulled across the windows. I open up a touch to see if I can sense any night runners within, and come up blank. For one of the first times I've opened up in this fashion, there aren't any images or sense of others around. It's just a blank space. I look across the lot behind us and catch Gonzalez's eye. She looks at me questioningly as to whether there are any night runners inside. I shake my head, letting her know I can't sense any. Gonzalez steps up next to McCafferty by the front door. McCafferty leans in to whisper in Gonzalez's ear.
"Will you do the same for me?"
I pick up McCafferty's whispered question. I'm guessing she's referring to her putting Gonzalez's night runner father to rest.
"Of course,"
Gonzalez whispers in return, and puts her hand on McCafferty's shoulder. I have Horace direct one of her Blue Team members to man our gun and bring Henderson and Denton up with us.
Well, here goes nothing,
McCafferty says. I literally feel the tension radiate from her and completely understand. It's a horrible feeling not knowing about your family and on the verge of finding out, especially with what we've seen in the few months since the world ended. We found some family members alive and well, but others that haven't made it. And it's not just from the Night Runners. The groups of people who feel like the world is now a place to do as they please and take advantage of others are just as dangerous as the Night Runners, if not more. The others of Red Team ready themselves on the porch as McCafferty opens the screen door. Its squeaky hinges are loud in the surrounding silence. She knocks on the front door. We stand in alert silence, waiting for the telltale approach of footsteps, the door opening, or even, perhaps, a call of, "Who's there?" No one answers. She reaches down to find that the door is locked. She looks back at the rest of us, and I see the disappointment in her eyes mixing with lines of tension. "Do you have any other family or friends around? They might have gone there," I ask.
"We don't have any other family close by, and they aren't ones to head to anyone else's house. They'd have stayed here regardless,"
she answers. "Let's take a look around the house," I say, thinking maybe the back door might be unlocked. Even if they aren't here, we can perhaps find some clue as to what happened to them or where they might have gone. We walk around, looking for open windows or some sign the house is inhabited, or was recently. Dry brown bushes lie against the outside walls along one side, evidence that McCafferty's parents once tried to give the place some color. As it is, the white house with peeling paint in places sits on the quiet lot, keeping its secrets, if it has any. McCafferty describes the layout as we progress. It's basically a large open room containing the living room, dining room, and kitchen on the right, with a hall leading to three back bedrooms and a bathroom on the left. It's close to the same layout as other houses we've been in. The back door is locked. We complete our circuit around the house with only the small puffs of dust from our footfalls and the heat keeping us company. Back in front, McCafferty retrieves a key from under a rock lying where the steps and porch meet. The fact that the doors are locked is a good sign with regards to Night Runners. I don't want to rely on whether I can sense them or not as fact. I figure if I can shut it away, then so can they. At least that's what I have to assume. Ugh, I so dislike that word, as I don't like to assume anything. But we have to do it in everyday life to some extent. With Henderson and Denton against the wall next to the front door, and me holding the screen open with my shoulder and aiming inside, McCafferty kneels and inserts the key into the lock. Robert stands behind me, ready to enter on my heels. Bree will stay at the door. The house isn't overly large, and too many inside will actually hinder movement and coverage rather than help. We've done this so many times together that we each know our place and initial movements, so very little briefing is needed. Remember, McCafferty's parents may be inside, so no itchy trigger fingers. Verify your target quickly, though, is the only thing I need to say. A click from the door lets me know McCafferty has unlocked it. I scan the area quickly and focus back on her giving a nod. She turns the handle and swings the door inward. Dropping my NVGs, I'm by her in a flash with Robert on my heels. I rush in about 10 feet and drop to my knees, scanning the large open room. Robert drops in beside me. A rustle and the sound of boots hitting the wooden entryway floor lets me know Gonzalez, Henderson, and Denton have entered and are behind me and to the right. The coolness of the room is a refreshing reprieve from the heat outside, although I don't notice it much with the adrenaline flow that entering any darkened and strange building brings. The rustle of clothing stops, and the quiet we felt in other houses settles in. Our lasers dance about the room as we search for movement, or anything to indicate we're occupying the same space with something or someone else. The room holds silent with no movement. An island sits in the middle of the kitchen, and dishes are stacked beside the sink. The dining room table is off to the side of the kitchen. The room has a sense of being lived in, and I half expect the TV to be on with viewers sitting on the couch and easy chairs. It doesn't quite have the loneliness the other houses had, but that feeling is still strong. McCafferty enters and kneels down beside Gonzalez. I get McCafferty's attention and have her gather close. Do you want you and Gonzalez to check out the hall and bedrooms, or have Henderson and Denton go instead? I ask. I know what happened to Gonzalez in her parents' house and want to give her the choice in case the same thing has happened here. I don't think any night runners are inside with the doors being locked, but that doesn't mean they aren't. It has to be hard not knowing, but it would be harder being directly confronted with it. I can't imagine how devastating that would be to see your parents as night runners and then be the one to have to put them down. For some reason, and maybe it's only me, it would be easier if someone else did it. On the other hand, I'm also thinking I would rather be the one. I want to give McCafferty the option that feels most comfortable to her.
I'm good, sir. We'll go,
she whispers, looking around the familiar room. Henderson and Denton cover the large room as McCafferty and Gonzalez edge toward the hall and check out its length. I stand close behind, ready to give additional cover should they need it. Looking down the hall, I see all of the doors are closed, which is either another good sign or a bad one. If there are night runners inside, then they've learned to operate doors and locks, and that wouldn't be a comforting thing, to say the least. I would head over to open the drapes and let the light in, but I don't want the light differential to interfere with our NVGs. I have mine on because of what Gonzalez said, and I'm trying to be less conspicuous. I watch as the two women enter the hall. Their thin points of light swing from door to door as they edge down the narrow corridor. I keep expecting to hear the familiar shriek or pounding against one of the closed doors, but the house remains quiet, with the exception of my heart pounding in my chest. I'm sure I'm taking years off my life by the constant adrenaline we seem to use up on an almost daily basis. I used to love that feeling, but now it just makes me feel old and tired. I so wish for the peaceful retirement I had going. I guess this is supposed to be a constant in my life for some reason. I can't imagine choosing this. I must have misread the line I was standing in. I had thought I left this life behind and was settling into a peaceful existence. But the world spoke up and said differently. I wonder if I'll ever reach that point again. I wish I was younger, though. It sure would make this a lot easier, I think, watching McCafferty and Gonzalez get ready to enter one of the rooms on the right. McCafferty swings the door open, and Gonzalez swings her M4 side to side, clearing the room. I can't see what kind of room it is, but I'm assuming it's a small one, as Gonzalez reaches down a moment later to touch McCafferty's shoulder. McCafferty closes the door. They cover each room in the same manner with the same result. There's no one here.
It's all clear, sir,
Gonzalez reports as they close the last door. Copy that, I respond. We gather in the open area to ponder our next move. I feel bad for McCafferty that she still doesn't have an answer, but there is the positive that we didn't find them dead or worse.
Jack, Greg here,
I hear on the radio. Yeah, Greg, go ahead.
We have someone standing in the driveway across the street.
Just one? Armed?
Yeah, it's just one person, and they are armed, but just holding their rifle loosely and looking in our direction,
Greg answers. Okay, we're on our way out, I say. Keep an eye out for others. I step into the bright light and heat. The house was cold in comparison, and the change in temperature makes me feel like I'm about to melt. It's that kind of heat that immediately makes me feel tired and lethargic. The sweat forms instantly, saturating my fatigues under my arms and where my vest is covering. I want to remove the vest just to feel the cooling sensation of the sweat evaporating, but that's not the best of ideas in an unknown area. I remember the times in the desert or jungle when we established our place to hold up and the refreshing sensation of taking my vest off. It's been a busy couple of days, and a nap is sounding like the best thing in the world right now. The release of adrenaline adds to this feeling. I walk with McCafferty over to where Greg's and Horace's vehicles are parked back-to-back on the dirt road by the entrance. The rest of Red Team takes up positions by the Humvee, parked close to the house. Looking into the lot across the road where Greg is pointing, I see a man standing next to a black pickup truck in the driveway. He's holding a rifle at his side, looking in our direction, shading his eyes from the sun. Horace is glassing the area with a set of binoculars. "Anything?" I ask Horace.
"Nothing I can see, sir,"
she answers. "Do you know who that is?" I ask McCafferty.
"Well, that could be Old Man Edmonds. At least that's his place. I never really talked with him much,"
she replies. "Well, let's see what he has to say. McCafferty, you're with me. The rest of you stay alert and cover us," I say. The M240 on Horace's Humvee is pointed in the man's direction, but not directly at him. Walking with McCafferty at my side, we cross the road and enter the opposite driveway. The man brings his hand down and grips his rifle, but doesn't bring it up in a threatening manner, just to a more ready position to use if needed. Closer, I see he's an older man, perhaps in his late 50s or early 60s. His deeply tanned and wrinkled face makes it hard to tell just how old he is. I'm sure the sight of armed vehicles and people in the area aren't giving him comfortable feelings, but I give him credit for his bravery in coming outside to check us out. "We're not looking to cause any trouble," I say, keeping my M4 ready but lowered. It's not like I don't have tremendous firepower behind me if needed, and I can literally feel the M240 trained in our direction. This trip has brought a few surprises, and I'm not really in the mood for more.
"Now that remains to be seen," he answers.
He thrusts his head forward as if trying to see better, as if the extra few inches will bring everything into more clarity.
"Is that you, young Allie?"
"Yes, sir,"
McCafferty answers.
"Well, come forward, girl. Let me get a good look at you," the man says. "And tell that youngin' on the big gun to quit pointing it at me."
I have everyone relax, but keep alert. Mr. Edmonds sets his rifle against the black pickup truck, reaches behind him, and brings out a green John Deere hat covered with dirt and grease stains. He slaps it against his jeans as if that'll clean it, although it does release a small cloud of dust, and places it on his head. We walk the remaining distance down the driveway.
"Well, you certainly have grown, girl. Look at you. I'm glad to even be saying that," Mr. Edmonds says. "And you would be?"
"Jack Walker," I say, slinging my M4 and sticking my hand out.
"Jim Edmonds,"
he returns my shake.
"Mr. Edmonds, do you know what happened to my parents?"
McCafferty asks.
"Well, young Allie, I don't rightly know,"
Jim says, looking at the ground and then back at her.
"I last saw him a few days ago. Let's see, that'd have been 5 days ago by my count. They mentioned they were heading out to look for supplies, and I haven't seen him since."
Both hope and disappointment cross McCafferty's face. The news that they made it through this far is good news, but the fact that they went out for supplies and haven't returned in days doesn't bode well. We've all been out for supplies and know what that means. I hope for her sake they didn't come across a Night Runner lair in their search. "Are there any Night Runners in the area?" I ask.
"Any what?"
Jim asks in confusion, squinting his eyes and scratching his head.
Oh, you mean them night hunter things? Yeah, I hear them prowling around at night.
I look at the small house that has no evidence of being fortified. The house actually looks like the big bad wolf could huff and puff his way in. So how is it you've managed to keep them at bay? I ask, curious as to how he's kept them out.
Well, young man, I've been staying in a storm shelter. Figured if it can protect against a tornado, then it should be able to hold up against them night folk.
Jim answers.
And shared it with your parents when the storms would come blowing in, and recently.
He continues, directing this at McCafferty.
Of course, we're in tornado country. I should have known,
I think. Any idea where they might have gone to search or what might have happened to them? I ask. We still have a few hours to search before we have to head back. We could hole up in the Humvees for the night and search for them tomorrow, but that isn't the most comfortable of solutions. The vehicles are tough, but not impenetrable. Enough night runners could turn them over, and that wouldn't be in our best interest.
I'm not exactly sure where they might have gone. They could have run afoul of the group holed up in the prison, though. I've seen that group around from time to time and watched them snag some poor souls off the streets once while I was out for supplies myself. I'm not sure why they took them and didn't hang around long enough to find out.
I feel the tension radiating from McCafferty. I can understand her feelings. If there's a chance to get her parents, she wants to take it, and I don't blame her. But she also knows we're limited on personnel and resources. And time. Any idea how many are holed up in there?
No idea at all. I'm not stupid enough to venture down that way.
Well, again,
I was out that way once for supplies. Got myself chased for my trouble. They came directly out of that prison and damn near caught me. Eventually lost them on the back roads. Haven't ventured close since,
Jim answers.
If I were to guess by the number chasing me, I'd say 20 or 30.
I have an immediate liking for Mr. Jim Edmonds. He's a survivor and seems pretty crafty. I don't suppose you know the layout of the place, I ask.
Well, there I might be able to help you some. I worked there as a guard for some time when times were tough,
Jim replies. We spend the next half hour putting together a diagram based on Jim's recollections of the facility. It's a large place, and I'm not really sure how we can take it with only three teams. It's a lot like Madigan in that we'd need a battalion, well, at least a company to be effective. And that's if we can even get in. Prisons are designed to keep people both in and out. Jim, you're more than welcome to come along with us. I mean, back to the Northwest, if you'd like. We have supplies and shelter, I say after folding the map.
Oh, I don't rightly know about that. I'd feel bad if young Allie's parents came back and I wasn't here. I suppose I could leave a note, though, but a lot of good that would do. Still, I guess if they ain't been here in 5 days, odds are...
Jim pauses, giving McCafferty an apologetic look.
Well, I suppose that'd be okay. Not much here for me anyway since Sarah passed on. Let me grab some things. I'll be right with you.
We head back to the road and gather the others up. I explain the situation. I feel completely indecisive about what to do. On the one hand, if McCafferty's parents are there, then we should do the right thing and get them out. Or at least try. I mean, that goes if anyone's being held against their will, but more so because it's the family of one of our own. But we don't know, and should we risk the others of our teams not knowing if they're there? Should we risk our team members even if we knew they were there? Our months have been about staying alive, but there's also the right thing to do. I mean, that is, if there is a way in, and we don't create a worse risk or stupidly throw our lives away. The heat isn't improving my ability to think this one through. All right, I have to be honest and say, I'm not sure on this one. I give McCafferty the same apologetic look that Jim gave her.
We took down the high school and there were about the same amount of bad guys there,
Horace mentions.
True, but that was a high school. We're talking about a prison here. The high school is infinitely easier to infiltrate. Prisons are meant to be hard to not only get out of, but into, I reply, as Jim walks out with a filled duffel bag and his rifle. But we could take a look and see what we're facing before making any decisions.
That couldn't hurt, Greg says.
Okay, let's go take a look and see what we're dealing with then. Just a look for now, as we have to be back before dark. We'll make our plans based on what we see, I say. Jim, can you get us close discreetly?
I know a few back ways. I think I can get you close, but it's surrounded by fields, so you may not be able to get as close as you'd like,
he answers. Okay, let's mount up then. The teams break up and climb into their vehicles. Jim climbs in with Greg as our Humvee is already a little crowded. Greg will lead with us following. We'll have to keep it slow so we don't kick up a lot of dust and give ourselves away. The day is already into the afternoon, and it won't be too much longer before we have to begin our journey back. There is still the town we have to circumvent, and I want to allow time for delays. McCafferty and I walk back to our Humvee.
Thank you, sir,
McCafferty says as we stroll back, stirring the dust with our boots. We'll get them if they're there and we can. No promises, though. I know this is hard, but we can't risk losing our teams, I say.
I understand, and wouldn't have it any other way, sir.
Then let's go and see what we're dealing with, shall we? I see some tension leave her with the fact that we're going to try and do something, but I know she must be feeling anxious not knowing. I mean, they may not even be there.
I'm with you, sir,
McCafferty replies. With Jim guiding, our little convoy proceeds slowly on backcountry roads. I'm at an interval behind Greg's Humvee, watching the little dust he's kicking up as we inch along. The surrounding fields are completely covered with dirt, and the flat land makes us stand out like we're waving banners and throwing confetti. I'm not sure just how close we're going to be able to get, and even if we do get close, I don't think we'll be able to see much over the walls I'm assuming are there. But anything we can do to help a teammate is worth doing, as long as we don't all get killed over it. That result is definitely over in the don't want to do column. My kids are with me, so that is to be avoided at all costs. There's a hierarchy in my thinking. My kids, Lynn, the teams, everyone else. I don't figure much into that equation, but I'm not in an all-fired rush to leave this fucked-up world either. We begin heading down small service roads between the fields themselves, and eventually find ourselves in a small gully. Shrubs dot the hillsides on both sides, and the road ends at a shallow creek at the bottom of the gully. Small, stunted mesquite trees line the water's edge. Greg pulls to a stop. We shut down and exit. The gully is deep enough to hide the vehicles without betraying a silhouette. A rancid smell permeates the area. And by rancid, I mean enough to want to stop breathing entirely. Everyone wrinkles their nose and waves their hand under them upon exiting. It's definitely something that died, and, by the smell of it, it is many of those things. There's nothing else that smells like that, and I'm all too familiar with that odor. I wonder if someone's been dumping bodies in the gully.
There's one of the largest cattle pens in the country on top of this gully, Jim says, chuckling at our reaction. Damn, smells more like someone shit in my nose, I hear Denton mutter. Follow this stream to the west and where it makes a bend back to the east.